Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we shall go back to the book, The Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. I think it's our 67th episode on the book. It just goes to show how many treasures this book holds, because even after 66 sessions of 1.5 hours, we are, I think, still about 3/4 way into the book, another quarter to go. It's been a very beautiful journey, very enlightening journey. I have personally learned so many things, and there's one aspect today which really, really excited me, because it was a kind of a thought that I often had intuitively or instinctively, and I had even shared this thought with a few of my classmates and friends about one particular way of functioning of the universe. And was I pleasantly thrilled and surprised to see that Swami is saying the exact same thing in this book. Of course, the original is Bhagwan, because this conversation has been recorded way before even I was born. But it was very, very thrilling for me to see that what I had intuitively and instinctively felt was being said even by Bhagwan. So many things other than that, of course, are there. But before we go into that, a quick summary of where we concluded last week. Last week we concluded with an example where Swami says that there is a knife that a surgeon uses, and there is a knife that even the villain uses. While the surgeon uses it to operate on patients and give them health, a villain uses it to butcher people. Before that, Swami had given the example of Lord Jesus, how he was able to see the shiny teeth of a shiny teeth in the body of a dead decaying dog, and while all others just saw the way the body was mangled or the stink and stench that emanated from that. So Swami says that it all depends on your perspective, on your vision, how you view things. Good and bad are created completely from the way you view or from your perspectives. And that's why Swami concludes by saying, do not fill the mind with thoughts of evil actions that may be perceived in the world. And he says that the purpose of all types of sadhana is to train the mind to see divinity in everything. That is the adjustment sadhana that you have to do. You have to adjust your lives, your professions, or whatever you are doing in such a manner that you are able to perceive the divinity or good that is present in all. It is totally in sync with what we have learned, that yogaha chitta shuddhi, I forget the quote.
Nirodhaka.
Virodhaka.
Chitta vritti nirodhaka.
Chitta vritti, haan. The purpose of our sadhana is to purify this chitta, to purify, to cleanse ourselves of all our vasanas and impulses that we have brought in. And Swami says that that is what you should do, that is what is the sadhana that you should do. The best way to do it is to look for and search for the good in everything, because the good in everything is the God in everything. I think that is where we had concluded last week's conversation. We will be taking on from then on, and a lot of practical questions, as always, Hislop asks. Very, very interesting answers. It will be definitely an exciting hour ahead. So, welcome all of you, and welcome Brother Prem, Sairam.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. Yes, it's episode where a lot of important practical tips are going to be given by Swami, and if we were posed some of these questions, probably we will dilly-dally a little bit, but Swami is very clear, very, very certain how he wants some of these situations to be dealt with. So we'll be going through some of that, and it starts with a very practical question. As we have mentioned before, apart from being a sadhaka, apart from being a devotee of Swami, Dr. Hislop also was, I think, appointed in some important post. I don't know exactly what it was called then.
It was, I think, equivalent to the president for America,
right.
Satya Sai Organization.
Satya Sai Organization of America. So don't know the exact title which was given to him then. So a lot of questions that he asks are also based
as
an office bearer, what he has to convey. And as we can see, towards the end of this conversation, he says that I've exhausted the list that I came with. So in that sense, the question that he asks is on behalf of some of the devotees back in the US or elsewhere in the world whom he might be interacting with. So he asks Swami, devotees in New York would like to have a guideline for personal life similar to the administrative guidelines for centers. So very clearly he's asking about what a Sai devotee must follow on a daily basis, right? You have followers of various religions, cults and groups. They have certain, you could call them rituals or certain practices through which they define their identity as belonging to, you know, such and such an organization or being followers of such and such a
group,
group or a master. So in that sense, there's very clear guidelines that Swami has given for centers. We have come through some of them. So he's asking about devotees. And Swami's answer is very lucid. And Swami says, the first thing that Swami says is, the principal thing is that the life and the work should be dedicated to God. So I think there are multiple things that is conveyed only in that one simple line that Swami is giving. You cannot dedicate your life and work to God if you do not have faith in the existence of God. So I think the first and foremost thing is, there's no question, all of them should be believers in God and should be theists in the sense that you should, I mean, as Swami would say, that it is not that you have to believe that God has this form, he has four arms. If you want, if that is the best way you can commune with him, think of God as love. Think of God as truth. But believe that there is a God to whom I can make my offering, and that offering is accepted with love.
I think that's a good point you're making, because as far as I remember, when Swami was putting out the guidelines for an office bearer, it was mandatory that the office bearer be a believer of Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba.
Right.
That Swami made it very clear. And so therefore, here it is slightly different. Though the people who come to the various centers, they need not be, followers or believers in this form of God, which is Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba. They definitely need to have faith in God, because as you rightly said, you can't dedicate anything to God unless you have faith that there is
right.
a God. So that is a difference which shows how practical, logical and liberal Swami is. Of course, if you are an office bearer, I mean, you definitely have to have faith in the form and name, because you are representing that form and name. How can you represent a name and form if you don't have faith in that name and form?
Right.
That is the reason where it is made mandatory for office bearers. But a devotee, you are free to welcome, explore. And many times it so happens that a devotee gets made into a office bearer. At that time, you have to ascertain that they have faith in this name and form. Else, they can remain as devotees. But even as devotees, it's important that you live up to the word devotee, meaning
right.
you have faith in God.
Exactly. And the statement where Swami says that life and work should be dedicated to God, I think that also makes it clear that there is no specific work, there is no specific lifestyle in the sense of, you know, you take up sannyas or you come and live in a monastery. There's nothing like that. Your life, your work, what you're doing has to be dedicated to God. So which again is probably a hint at what Swami always says, that whatever work you do, do it as worship. And when you say dedicating something to God, it comes with a entire set of explanations how you must work if you wish to dedicate whatever you do to God. So much is conveyed just in that one statement. And
it is evident that it's a very, very broad statement.
Right.
Possibly that's what leads Hislop to ask the next question, that Swami, they would like a series of do's and don'ts to guide them throughout the day. That's what we want. Swami, you tell us what to do, what not to do. That's enough. And Swami says, there are so many different vocations and professions that each has its appropriate code of behavior. One vital principle, however, for everyone is to do no harm to others. We should do everything in our power to help others. Again, another beautiful reply where Swami says that, you know, giving do's and don'ts requires us to go into individual cases. There are so many vocations, so many professions, so many age groups, so many kinds of people in so many means, you know, you can make so many worldly divisions. So if you have to make do's and don'ts, it requires us to go specifically into each of it. But as a general thing, across all divisions, across all ages, across all professions, what is true is help ever, hurt never.
Right. So Swami is making it very clear that this is not something that Swami always says. You don't have to give up something that you're already following, be it a religion, be it a profession. You must get better, more useful, and more service-minded in whatever you're doing, in whatever you're following. So I think that is conveyed in what Swami says, that you have to ensure that you don't harm others. Swami would often say that, you know, help ever, hurt never is the basis. But forget, if you're not able to help, that is also fine. But ensure that you do not harm anybody in the process.
You know, sometimes when we look at these quotes by Bhagwan, love all, serve all, help ever, hurt never, they appear to be very simple and not in sync with what we think is spiritual progress. Spiritual progress means some complicated mantra should be there, some rigorous austerity has to be practiced. So, Swami, what is the teaching? And Swami says, help ever, hurt never. I'm reminded of a Sanskrit quote which says, Ashtadasha Puraneshu Vyasasya Vachanadvayam Paropakaraya Punyaya Papaya Parapidanam, which means that from the 18 Puranas that Vyasa has written, he has distilled the essence of all the 18 Puranas into two statements, which is Paropakaraya Punyaya Papaya Parapidanam, meaning that it is merit to help others and it is sin to hurt others. So Swami so easily actually has spoon-fed us the distillate of the 18 Puranas. So it is appearing very simple. Because it is simple, I mean, to understand it is simple, it is tough only when we have to practice it. When we start practicing it, we will realize how this simple statement like help ever, hurt never becomes so difficult. And Swami, as you rightly said, has given us a modification also, saying that even if you can't help, at least refrain from hurting in your thought, word and deed. Actually, when we practice it, we will see that even doing that much without helping anyone, but just refraining from hurting anyone in our thought, word and deed, we find it so tough. Maybe we will refrain hurting others in our deeds, but words become so much more difficult. Even if we manage to keep maunam, silent, and say, no, I will not speak only so that I don't hurt anyone. Thoughts. Oh my God, how many times in our thoughts we curse people, we think of, you know, think ill of others. So it is definitely a very simple statement, but it requires a lifetime of practice to follow.
Right, and as you said, you know, when Swami says dedicate all your actions to God and then says don't hurt others, both have a... take our life to a different dimension, as I was reflecting a few days back. For most of us, the way we were leading our life before we came to Swami, if there's a point that we can say that, you know, before this I was not a devotee or I was not very serious about my relationship with Swami. We were living a life which was probably passable when looked at from the point of view of the world and the world's measuring standards. But the moment you say, I am a Swami's devotee, I am a student of Swami, or I have to live my life in a way that it is worthy of being dedicated to Swami, the standards by which you will measure yourself will be completely different. And this standard is not only physical or outward, it also includes what happens inside. And that's what makes it more challenging. That's what makes it a full-time job, right? If you have to please only outwardly, then your work is only probably 6 hours that you go out and you're a professional, this one. Or even as a father, that time that you spend with a child, or even as a husband or a mother or a son, it is only in relationship with that person. But the moment you say, as a devotee, I have to be as perfect as I can, it's a full-time job. It's a 24 hours you have to be at it. And that includes everything. My role as a professional, my role as a team leader, as a boss, as a husband, as a son, as a father, mother, everything is included in this 24-hour duty as a devotee that I am spending.
In other words, when we have to be good for the world, I have to appear good to the world. Here, I have to appear good even to my own self, and I am witnessing myself 24/7. So that's why it becomes a very, very difficult thing. I have to really become good, because I can put on an act for a few hours every day, but I cannot act 24/7. I mean, if I'm acting 24/7, that is what I am. That is what I'll have to become. Because I am witnessing my swabhava, my nature, my mind. So that's why it becomes very, very difficult. Going ahead, Hislop says, a big problem that faces these young people is that of drugs. It is a general belief that marijuana is not harmful. And Swami says, at first a drug may make the person feel strong and confident. But all drugs are unnatural in their effect on the mind and they do positive harm to the brain and to the spiritual capacity. The spiritual aspirant, the devotee of God, should not use drugs. So, Swami says that in the initial you get a kick, and I mean this is what even science has discovered, that drugs have a very short-term benefit, and from medium-term to long-term they are only bad and devastating. In fact, after reading this, I just tried to do a search online for any benefits of marijuana. Scientifically, there are none other than extremely short-term, where you get a short-term boost in relaxation and...
skillfulness also sometimes. It makes you more skillful in a short term.
In a very short term. Right. Very short term, because they say that even when you take a thing like 3 days, 4 days, you see your memory failing you, your grasping ability comes down, your analytical reasoning, logical reasoning, all of that comes down. And so Swami says here that it is definitely bad. Another point that came in my mind is, you know, we never search online, is eating rice bad? Is eating an apple bad? The very fact that sometimes you wonder, you get a doubt whether it is good or bad, itself shows that possibly it is bad. I just don't want it to be bad because I want to indulge in it. When people ask, you know, is watching movies bad? Why is this question coming? You never ask, is singing bhajans bad? Correct? But you ask, is watching movies bad? Because somewhere you feel that, hey, somewhere it may be bad in some way. So, but at the same time, you are entertained by it, you enjoy it, and that's why you wish to, you hope secretly that maybe I'm wrong and it is good. But Swami says the conscience in everyone is absolute. It definitely gives you the right answer. It just requires your practice and training to be able to hear it and put into practice what it says, because every time you put into practice what your conscience says, it grows stronger for the next time. So Swami clearly says that even those short-term benefits are only for the body and the mind, because as far as spirituality is concerned, it's a strict no-no. If you have even the slightest inkling towards spirituality, you have to give up drugs, or better still, don't even enter into drugs.
Right. I mean, from the previous conversation that Swami had also about, you know, what is it to be a Swami's devotee, and we've discussed this in the other satsangs also, it calls for a conscious lifestyle. Right? You have to consciously decide what you speak. You have to consciously decide how you act. And in a deeper level, consciously look at every thought and say, is this good or bad? Right? So in general, even spiritual life is all about being very, very alert. They would say that you become a very alert and a vigilant person, and your vigilance towards yourself is kept at a peak all the time. And when you look at all of these substances, be it drugs or be it intoxicants, they actually lower your ability to be sharp over a long period of time. Mm. And even generally, if you look at spirituality, they would say that all of us can experience that bliss of oneness in deep sleep. Right? So that is that experience of oneness which is given in the depth of tamas. Right? And as many of the spiritual masters say, what we are trying to achieve is to have that same state of deep peace in wakefulness. That is, with a conscious mind, you should be able to believe that this ahankara does not exist. So all that we are doing is that challenge. That because the mind is not ready to, you know, accept that when it is wakeful. Mm. So all of sadhana is keep the mind wakeful, and through that wakefulness, achieve the state of peace. And what we are trying to do in all these substance abuse or taking these kind of artificial, that's what Swami says, the benefits are artificial, because many people have this misconception that you can reach a spiritual state through the use of these drugs. Mm. Because yes, they will give you a sense of euphoria or whatever, but that is when the guard of the mind is dropped, just like how you feel it when in deep sleep. But that is only a pseudo-spiritual state. And that is not how spirituality can be achieved. Spirituality should be achieved when the mind is active, and very consciously with the mind in tow, you kind of achieve that state of oneness.
And in fact, adding to what you say, even in deep sleep, at least there are no harmful effects.
Exactly.
That is, in fact, sloth and inertia is better than taking drugs. If you feel that you need to experience it, sleep more often, sleep in the afternoon. Though tamas is not recommended, tamas is better than drugs because tamas at least doesn't...
Exactly. In fact, Swami never says that tamas should be removed. Mm. Swami always gives the example of the fan which has three blades, tamas, rajas, and we've spoken about the three gunas and all that. So Swami only says that it has to be given the place that it has to be given. This is like extending that tamas, actually.
This has no place, actually.
Right, no place, and you're making it more dangerous by giving it space in your life.
See, at least drugs, you know, you see the blatant harm it does to the body. But when it comes to something like non-vegetarian food, a lot of people ask this because non-vegetarian food apparently has many benefits for the body. It builds you stronger. There are certain kinds of proteins which vegetarians struggle to get it, or it's much more costly. This kind of all protein available in one place, you don't get it. But what we have to remember is, even though non-vegetarian food is possibly having benefits for the body, when it comes to the mind and the soul, which is spirituality, it's definitely bad. So, the same statement that Swami makes, that for the spiritual aspirant, the devotee of God should not use drugs, the same statement Swami makes with respect to even meat. Swami says that meat, if you want to grow spiritually, if you are interested in God, if you want to become a devotee, then give up meat. I'm saying this because, unlike drugs, meat seems to have a positive impact on the body at least. But even then, Swami says, it doesn't have a good impact on the spirit at all. Spiritual progress becomes very difficult or impossible with meat eating. So that is the first thing you have to give up. And when we look at our ancients, you know, look at all the people who have attained realization. Please don't bring in the example of Jesus or Shirdi Sai Baba. I'm not talking about the actions of God here, because actions of God is beyond our understanding. But if we look at spiritual aspirants who grew, most of them have actually given up meat and stuck to a very frugal sattvic diet to assist in the spiritual progress. And that is what we have to keep in mind. From a spiritual perspective, all these are strictly no-no, whether it is drugs, whether it is alcohol, whether it is smoking, whether it is meat, all these are no-no.
Right. And the next part of the conversation again is on a different note. It continues from there. But Hislop asks, Swami, most young people, not only in New York, have the desire to or feel pressure to engage in intensive social life. What is the correct attitude for Sai devotees? And Swami's reply to that is, social service, yes. Idle social life is not good. Then Hislop further asks, Swami, the devotee arises in the morning, and then what for the day? And probably we'll take a break there and go to that next question. So when it comes to social life, Swami is very, very clear. A lot of people ask this question, what is Swami's stance about social life? One thing that would be Swami's standard instruction to Swami's students when we were all in Swami's college is, have less contacts. Swami was very clear about that. It does not mean that you make yourself unavailable to others. Swami would again make that also very clear. Swami would say you should be available when somebody needs you, when somebody needs a patient listening, when somebody needs a help. But at the same time, try as much as possible to restrict yourself to what is required and don't engage more than that. Mm. So this again is something that Swami would often say. How much one can practice it varies from place to place, right? In fact, one thing that I always recall is when we were in the hostel, we had a very friendly and very brotherly relationship with everyone, but many times we would not know anything about the other person's personal life.
Exactly. Right?
We wouldn't even know which state that person comes from. It was really surprising. After 3 years, I would figure out that the person who was sitting next to me was, I mean, a cupboard mate or a classmate of mine was probably a Kannadiga or a Malayali, and we would have never known that. You know, unless that person really has an accent which gives it away or something like that. Many times, especially if that student comes from the school or the primary school, you'd never know that at all. And it is not that that makes you feel distant from that person. Mm-hmm. You know.
No, in fact, when you say this, I remember one of the classmates whom I considered as a close friend. You know, you have your own circles there also.
Right.
In the sense, some you are friendly with everyone. I remember being in Vrindavan hostel. I knew 300 students in the hostel. All the 3 years, I'm sure we would know everybody. Of course, in Prashanthi and Liam, the number gets much bigger, so it's tough. But in Vrindavan, we knew everybody, and your roommates will be a little more close to, and then your roommates, meaning about 14, 15 of them. In that, there will be maybe 5, 10 whom you have similar tastes, similar ideas, and therefore you bond with a little more. But one such friend, if I can say so, one such brother, in some context when I was mentioning, it took me 2 years to find out that he didn't have a father. And it was a shock for me, like, oh, then I thought of all the things that I have said which might have actually been insensitive. But it just highlights what you're saying. Though we are in contact with each other, we don't know so many aspects of each other's personal life, and we don't probe into to find out more either.
Right, exactly. In fact, the nature of the friendship, if you look at it, I still recall I had a friend who was a classmate, who was also my roommate, and he used to sit next to me in the desk because the roll numbers was in such a way that he was sitting next to me in the lab. Much of that first few months, whatever exposure to Swami was available, it was from him. You know, every day he would say that, you know, this is what Swami would like, and he would give examples from his school days, how Swami would react to different situations, how Swami would be happy when some things are done. Probably, if I look back, some things were his understandings and misunderstandings of Swami, but that was so important in that initial few months, because it also gives you the idea that this is how I must live, and this is what probably will please Swami. You might be too conservative, you might be doing some things wrong, but it doesn't really matter. But beyond that, I did not know much about him. I probably, even today, if you ask me what language was his mother tongue, I don't know what it was. But what was necessary in that time, you know, that relationship with Swami was the most important. That was bolstered by that company that that brother gave. But that was all. Nothing more than that. He much later, I got to know that he had a sister who was studying in Anantapur, and none of that you knew about that person's family, that person's background. Just about his relationship and Swami, that much which was necessary for your relationship with Swami. And I can say that about so many other teachers in the hostel who used to give so much of their wisdom and their experience about Swami with us. But you wouldn't know more than that.
And in fact, is Swami's definition of a good friend.
Good friend, exactly. I was just thinking of that. So I think that is what is important, that, you know, when you talk of how social can your social life be, if your social life is taking you closer to Swami, then it is being worthwhile. If it is taking you away from Swami, then I think it needs to be dropped then and there.
We can possibly remember this, I don't know from where I picked up this quote or a saying, but it gives a thumb rule. It says that great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, low minds discuss people. So it's not as if somebody is a great mind, somebody is an average mind, somebody is a low mind. I myself have been a great mind at times.
Exactly. All of us have.
It's just that if our social life can be focused more towards discussing ideas, things that inspire us, and as you said, the greatest inspiration is to move closer to God. In that direction, then that's great. That becomes satsang. It's not social life. But if it is tending more towards event and worse possibly towards discussing people, I think that is nothing but gossip, and it better to be avoided, because it is there even in the 9-point code of conduct to avoid gossip. To avoid gossip, we have to avoid that kind of socialization. On that note, dear listeners, we will take a quick little break, because the next question is when Hislop asks, as Prem read out, that okay, Swami, because Swami is giving a general answer that so idle social life is not good, so Hislop asks, so then Swami tell, how does the devotee spend the day? He gets up in the morning and then what? Swami gives a very beautiful reply which all of us can use in our lives, but that will come to us after the break.
प्रणाम शत कोटि प्रणाम शत प्रणाम शत कोटि प्रणाम
कोटि प्रणाम शत कोटि प्रणाम
हे दीननाथ साईरा शत कोटि प्रणाम हे दीननाथ साई राम।
वेलकम बैक डियर लिसनर्स, वी वर अबाउट टू गो इनटू द अनदर डिस्कशन व्हिच इज बिगिनिंग वेयर हिसलप आस्क्ड दिस क्वेश्चन। The devotees, after they arise in the morning, what is it that they must do? In fact, he is just rephrasing the question. Initially, he said, how should individuals live their life? Swami gave a general answer. Then he said, Swami, what are the do's and don'ts? Again, Swami gave a very general answer. So I think now he is trying to break it down and saying, okay, Swami, when they wake up in the morning, what is the first thing that they must do? The devotees arises in the morning and then what for the day? Then Swami gives a very beautiful and specific answer. Swami says, the awakening each morning should be a new birth. After awakening, be quiet for a few minutes. Pray to God for strength to live the day in dedication to Him and for the strength to help others. At night time, there is a new death. Recollect the day, but not in detail, and offer it to the Almighty. In the morning, the day was dedicated to God. At night, the day's work and its fruit is laid as an offering at His lotus feet.
It's so practical, so beautiful. And I say this with an experience of at least 10 days. Because we had read through this for last week's satsangs itself. And I just thought, let me try it. And otherwise, you know, every morning you get up. Invariably now your alarm clock, your computer, your contacts, your everything is your phone now. It's another organ in the body. And every time it would happen that morning I get up and turn to my left and see the phone and see the time there. And after that, some of the first 5-10 minutes just go into quickly seeing what all has gathered as, you know, what do you call that on top as
notifications.
Notifications. Right. You just quickly look at all the notifications and then you begin the day. So I decided that
miss me when I was asleep?
Yeah, from, you know, did some comments come, some did thing happen. And especially if we have done a satsang or YouTube video, you know, mind is like that. You know, you feel like going and, oh, what comments, what has anybody said? Have they said good things about me? Because, you know, honestly, reading good things about yourself makes you feel very good in the beginning of the day. But then I thought, you know, having read this, I thought, let me try this, you know. So morning I get up, see the time on my phone and then keep back the phone. The notifications can wait for 5 minutes. Let me just tell this to Swami. And the last 10 days definitely have been beautiful. And that is the power. That is the power of Swami's words. That is the truth. Swami says here, you know, few minutes. When you read it, you think, few minutes, will it make a difference? Yes, it makes a huge difference. Just start the day by thinking of Swami and telling Swami, thank you for giving me another day. It's a beautiful day. May I spend this day thinking about you. May the activities I do in this day make me grow in my love for you. And may I be a good instrument in your hands. May I be of help to anyone who seeks my help. Just this much, you know. And just think of His beautiful form in the mind and then wake up. Wow, the day gets transformed. This is so, so practical and so real, as I say, because I have tried it out for the last 10 days and I'm inspired. I'm thinking if I can do it for more than 5-10 minutes. It so happens that the initial josh or the initial enthusiasm, you're able to do it. But if you think that let me do it for 10 minutes every day, it might get tough. I think that is the loving and sweet Lord we have who says do it for a few minutes. Few minutes definitely possible and it gives a lot of positive benefits. And Swami says you start it like that. And night time again, Swami says recollect the day, not too much in detail. Again, this I appreciate the beauty of this statement because, you know, when I'm recollecting my day, sometimes when I go a little into the detail, the mind is such a monkey, it goes into the detail and then it drills from there into something else, something. Within 3 minutes, you are thinking something totally unrelated and you wonder, hey, how did I reach here? And that's why I think Swami says, think of all the things that happened, not in great detail, and offer it to Swami. This is definitely a very beneficial and highly recommended practice. Recommended since because Swami Himself has said it, but I am adding my personal recommendation because just in 10 days, I have seen the beautiful impact or effect of this practice.
Right, and my experience of this is once you start trying to practice this regularly, this itself will become a sadhana. I was telling someone the other day that if you can ensure that the first thought when you wake up in the morning is Swami, and the last thought you drift away in the night is Swami, then you've lived the day properly. Because you will find out that without having lived a proper day, you know, doing all this right during the day, you will not have that last thought of Swami. Because as Swami would say, saying here very clearly and generally says, the sleep that you have is the death that you have every day. And when Swami says that to have that last thought before you die as God, you need to live a good lifetime, then only you will have that last thought as God. That holds true even for the day. You know, you could practice it once or twice as a sadhana, like I can for 1 week, 10 days. But if it has to happen like a regular thing through your life, you will find that you will have to make lifestyle changes to ensure that the last thought when you sleep is Swami, and the first thought, as soon as you wake up, spontaneously, sometimes when you wake up and you'll know, you'll think of Swami. And sometimes it comes as blessing from Swami, but if it has to come as our effort, you will find that the whole day has to be restructured so that this happens.
You know, practically from what you say, I feel it's easier to think of Swami first thing in the morning than to think of Him last thing in the night.
Right.
Let me again share my experience of the last 10 days itself. I used to think of something, you know, a night you do something, sometimes you end up watching sometimes television or you read some book or something. But even after that, when I lie down on the bed, I start thinking of Swami, pure Swami. But as I'm starting to drift into sleep, again the mind, you know, which is semi-awake also, starts drifting, goes away from Swami, and it is so difficult to end on a Swami note. It is so difficult to say in the morning that before I slept last night, the last thought was Swami, because the mind drifts off. And then, you know, I tried something else, which is, I've been doing this for the last 4 nights, putting on my earphones and putting on the disco stream. I thought, now when it's Swami's voice I'm hearing, how will I think of anything else other than Swami? And, you know, as you're listening, as the body tires, you start feeling sleepy. So, suppose Swami is explaining some concept. And it, like a frog, it jumps here, the monkey mind really, you know, it catches on to some one word there, concept there, and let me say, even while listening to Swami's own voice, the last few moments before you drift to sleep, when you feel so tired that you just, you know, silence the phone and pull out the earphones, your mind has gone to something else other than Swami. Something that Swami is speaking about, Swami says, take a tree. From the tree, your mind goes off to autumn, it goes off to some possibly United States, something, and a vacation you had. Somewhere it just drifts off. So, I totally agree with what you say. It is so difficult to ensure that the last thought before I sleep is Swami. Just imagine how much more it will be to ensure that the last thought before I die is Swami.
Right. But it's a very beautiful exercise that Swami is giving. Because at the end of the day, we know that we have to get there in spontaneity, but we need practice, abhyasa, and as Swami would say. So in that, this becomes a very, very beautiful tool. And Swami would say this every time to many devotees. In fact, one of the experiences I'm sure we have narrated before of an old student who suddenly had this urge. He was studying in Vrindavan. We all know Sonam sir. He had narrated this in a couple of our programs. He said that suddenly at one point when he was in Vrindavan, he felt this urge to come to Prashantinilayam for, I think, Isharama Day or something like that. But generally, students don't come. So he wrote a letter to Swami that, Swami, I feel like coming there and participating in this festival. And to his surprise, Swami sent word to the warden saying that he can come. So warden calls him one day and Swami says that, and warden tells him, Swami has sent word that you're permitted to come to Patti. And he was ecstatic. And as it always happens in the hostel, the next day an announcement was made that Brother Sonam is going to Patti to have darshan, and anybody has any letters, they can write it and give it to him, and he will hand it over to Swami. So he said that was a, you know, double boost to his ego, that of the whole hostel, I am the only one who's going, and now the whole hostel is going to give me their letters and prayers and supplications, and I am going to take it and offer it to Swami. So he said that, you know that it is wrong, but you also know that it is growing within you. So he took all the letters, he went to Patti, and he thought that, you know, Swami has permitted him. So the first thing that Swami sees him, Swami will come and tell him, how are you and how are all the boys, and then take the letter. And as we all know how Swami will react in a situation like this, Swami completely ignores him, completely doesn't look at him at all. Imagine you're the only student sitting there in the portico, and these are times in 70s, and you know how Swami would respond to students. Completely, Swami's looks beyond him, looks through him, and does not even acknowledge his presence. Swami comes out for darshan, calls people for interviews, nothing. Zero acknowledgement of him, and I think Swami also goes for bhajans. And it slowly starts sinking in, what a stupid thought I have nurtured all through these few days. It's a blessing that Swami is giving, that he has allowed me to come. How can I even allow my ego to come in? And all of that he was thinking, and he was repenting within himself. And then Swami calls him for an interview.
Mm.
And the moment Swami, he is in the brink of breaking down. And Swami calls him, and then Swami tells him, kitna ego, Swami tells him,
how much
ego do you have? Right? And that's it. He broke down. He fell at Swami's feet. He says, Swami, I'm not able to, there's no way I'm able to control it. It's there, right? It's not like I want it. It's not like I foster it. It's there. What do I do? Swami said, no problem. Very simple. Whenever that thought of ego comes, Swami said, just say, Sai Ishwara Arpanamastu, and offer it to Swami. Swami will take care. Right? And so beautifully Swami said, and he said that that's the easiest and the simplest instruction that Swami has given us. As we started off the discussion, it is all about being aware, being vigilant, being conscious to every thought.
Mm.
When it arises, you know it is bad. Anger comes, you know it is bad. Jealousy comes, you know it is bad. Ego comes, you know it is bad. Consciously say, Swami, I don't want this thought, and you offer it to Swami. Swami said, that's all is required. And it works like magic. And, you know, this is something that we all can experience. As you said, something like waking up in the morning and thinking of Swami is something that you can experience. It's a tangible benefit that you can feel. Same is the case with this exercise. So just that idea of dedicating everything, be it the first thought in the morning, the last thought in the night, or during the day, every time you need Swami's help, Swami says. And this is again a fallacy that most of us have, that we have to offer only the best part of us to Swami. Right? We always think that good thoughts you should offer to Swami. Only a pure mind you should offer to Swami. Swami says that is true from one point of view. But the other point of view is, who else is going to cleanse your mind other than me? If you're only going to give me what is best of you, then what am I here for? Swami says you should give me your mind with that all the stains of ego and all of that, and I will cleanse it for you. So that becomes a means.
Now, when you say this, I'm reminded of a beautiful poem I read in a book called Grains of Sand. It has been authored by B.K. Mishra, who is our English teacher from school. Very beautiful poem, and I remember the title of the poem, though I don't remember the poem by heart. The title of the poem is He Came A-Begging. And it was written, I think, before Swami's 70th birthday. So it was his offering to Bhagwan. So in that he wrote that one day there was a knock on his door, and when he opened the door, he saw a being, and the description of the being is, you know that it is Swami.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I have come to beg for alms. And Mishra sir writes that, I was surprised, and he says, what do you want? What do you want? He says, if you've got anything in your dustbin, dust can, whatever, kindly give it to me. I want to collect it in my bag. And Mishra says, no, why are you doing this? I don't want to give. He says, that is a tragedy. I have gone to a million houses so far and nobody is ready to give. See, my collection bag is fully empty. That's how the poem ended. And it was so poignant. It was like, Swami is not saying, give me your best. Swami is saying, give your junk to me. I will take off the junk. But we are so possessive of our junk, and we don't let go either of our hatred or our anger or anything like that. So, like you said, it's not that, how can I offer this to Swami? No, anything. Bring Swami in. Just like soap comes and cleanses anything.
Right.
Bringing Swami in itself cleanses that moment, cleanses that thought, cleanses that action. And like they say, well begun is half done. That is why possibly starting in the morning is very good. When we begin on a good note, half of the thing is done. When we get acquainted with Swami, when we go through His teachings, we realize, even here Swami is saying, people do many professions. What we do is not so important. More important is how we do it. And how we do it is decided by why we do it. What is our motivation behind it? If our motivation is divine, even a seemingly mundane action becomes worship. If our motivation is selfishness or evil, even if I'm doing bhajan or with an eye on getting name and fame, it doesn't become sadhana. It becomes a very cheap act. So the why we do it, that I think gets reinforced when we think of Swami right in the beginning of the day, in the morning. The purpose of our life, the purpose of our actions, the purpose of every moment is to reach Swami. So reminding ourselves of that, why am I, you know, why have I woken up, why I have been given this human body, it's for Swami. Swami is the why of our life. So when we think of the why of our life, it influences how we do. And possibly a time will come when it will influence even what we do. We will automatically keep away from those things that will take us away from Swami and focus on only those that will take us closer to Swami.
Right, and Swami is making it all the more simple for us. You know, had Swami told that every devotee when they wake up, they have to do this for 45 minutes and only then I will make you my devotee. I mean, Swami has made it so simple that, you know,
few minutes,
and it's all in how your life transforms doing all of this. And Swami says the next part of the conversation is based on a question again that Isla Pass. He says, Swami, new centers with maybe only 3 people want to have some other people come to their meetings, but months pass by and nobody comes. Could they do something like posting a notice or of their meeting at places like health food stores? So he's asking about, this must be more so in American cities, in those days, where people would probably want to come, but you know, it's very difficult to know where a center is today. The networks are very well networked. You know, if I'm going to a new city, I can find out beforehand where is the nearest Sai center, where is the nearest mandir, and I can go there. But those were the days when very small groups, you know, people would come to India, they would go back and they would start bhajans. So it's quite understandable. And most of the centers, I think even now, most of the centers are in devotees' houses where devotees have dedicated one hall or one floor of their house to Swami's activities. So Hislop is asking a very practical thing. Can we have information or notices about centers and meetings
posted in public spaces?
And Swami's answer, very simple, very clear. Swami says, no. And Swami explains, Swami prefers that additional people come only through observing the virtuous lives of center members and by word of mouth. Notices and such might start small, but in time they will get out of hand. Even such small things as notices will be taken as an advertisement for Swami. Other Swamis have to advertise and even provide transport, but Sai does not advertise. Yet thousands come. Sai even tells the people here to go home, but they stay. There is this difference.
And that's why Hislop says, then the small centers will need to just patiently wait for membership increase. Swami says, yes. You know, once again, very clearly, I think it boils down to the why of a Sai center. Whether it's a Samiti or Sai center, Swami is not focusing on what is being set up or how it is, but the why. And Swami says that the purpose of the Sri Sathya Sai organization itself is for the individual to recognize the Satya. That is why Swami says Satya is the first word in the name of the organization, to realize the truth that all are one. So the why of a Sai center or Samiti is for an individual's spiritual progress. So Swami once again is focusing back on that, because when we really focus on that, we will automatically know that what should be done, what should not be done. How will putting posters and getting publicity and getting more number of members help? Is it beneficial for my spiritual progress? Swami would say, even if it's one or two, I think in the same Conversations with God book, earlier we had come upon this point where he is discussing whether a center can be closed if nobody is attending. Swami says, yes, go ahead and close. But even if one person is attending or two people are attending, for their sake, it should be kept open. Because our purpose is not for bolstering our numbers. It is not for growing and not some expansionist kind of idea. It's about being there for anyone who requires assistance to grow spiritually. So, that is the why of the Sri Satya Sai organization. And therefore, there is no need for any kind of publicity. And Swami, again, very beautiful. You know, these are the things that we have experienced and seen. Today, you are saying notices. Tomorrow it will become advertisements. Day after it will become posts on Facebook. Then you will ask, there will be competition. My center has these many followers, yours has less. You know, all, we have seen all these happening today. And Swami easily, being God, foretold all that. And that's why he said, don't focus on that at all. Social media should not be the focus. Unfortunately, being a media organization, a part of our focus becomes social media. But as a Satya Sai Seva organization or Satya Sai International organization, Swami says, no, that is not. The focus should always be on the individual's spiritual growth. So there is no need for you working actively to increase the membership. Swami's emphasis has always been on the quality of members rather than the quantity of members. And that's why Swami says that looking at the members, people should feel inspired. Or people should speak about it, you know, that person really special. We go in, I mean, through either through word of mouth or through observation. That is the only way the membership should grow. In fact, I remember on one occasion, it was proposed to Swami that, Swami, we will not advertise about our hospital, but we will just present the facts. Swami said, no, every patient successfully and happily walking out will be our walking advertisement. No other kind of, information, whatever English word we try to camouflage it in. Swami, this is just awareness spreading. This is just information dissemination. No, not needed. Very clearly, because as you said, Swami answers it with just one two-letter word. No.
Right. And as we've, as an organization, when we've had discussions with, experts in the field, they always say this, you know, there are no half measures when it comes to advertising and when it comes to notices. You might think that, you know, I'm just going to put one notice somewhere, but it never stops with that. You know, automatically, it's not only about a competition between centers, but then, the field itself draws you. If you're doing it this way, then this is the best way to do it. And the best way to do it will involve a little more
expenditure,
involvement and an energy and all that. And there's no end to it. And automatically the focus completely changes. You know, when you talk of a center, the center should reflect Swami's purpose for that center, if I could put it that way. You know, what is Swami's purpose of putting a center like that? Because when we are into the center, our purpose changes. You know, if I am a center president, I'm thinking of, you know, I should have more people attending. Then the bhajans will be better. The study circle will be better. Those are all my purpose or my agenda. Swami's purpose is only that much. The individuals coming into that center should transform and go out, right? So I think that is the thing that you always have to go back to. If you're representing Swami's center, organization or a wing or whatever it is, are you serving the purpose that Swami had for that, or are you having your own purpose or agenda and you're trying to serve that? And Swami is very clear. I don't need, Swami is, as you said, even earlier he said, even if one person comes, two person comes, it is good enough. Right? Because I think we are living in a world where we are going by numbers. Oh, million followers, million people. Unfortunately, that is the reality. But you know, as I always keep telling, when Valmiki wrote the Ramayana, how many people read it? Today it is a global, it has global reach. But when he wrote it, probably the handful of people in his ashram were the first people to hear it. And then Lava Kusha went around singing it. And that's all was its reach. Imagine the greatest epic of its time. I mean, even now you don't have a poem that matches Ramayana and Mahabharata. How many verses? You know, it's like an epic of all epics.
But and that time only he knew it.
Only he knew it, and he just wrote it. And I mean, if you have to look at it that way, they speak of the Ramayana that Lord Hanuman wrote, which was supposed to be better than this, and he had no qualms of tearing it up, right? So it's not easy to have this attitude, But I think whenever in doubt, I think we should turn back to this and say that this is Swami's stance about
it. Recently in India, we had this unfortunate tragedy of a celebrity committing suicide. And the irony there was that you have million followers, but you are all alone. You know, I think spirituality is all about transforming our loneliness into solitude. At this point, I just remember a beautiful definition given by our GV sir, Professor G. Venkatraman, a man of profound words. He would tell something that would, it has still seeped in my mind, you know. After one of his talks, somebody got up and asked, "Sir, what is the difference between loneliness and solitude? Because in both you're alone, right?" GV sir said, "Atma Abhimanam." No, I was thinking, what answer is giving? How is Atma Abhimanam? Then he went on to explain. He said, when you have Dehabhimanam, when you have body attachment, you judge everything based on your body and others' bodies. Then you suffer loneliness. And at times you will be lonely even in the middle of a party. He said, but when you have Atma Abhimanam, when you associate with the divinity within you, you automatically realize the oneness of everyone around. There is no other at all. It's only one, and that is the divine. He says at that time, even if there is nobody around, you are so full, you feel so enriched, you feel so whole, because you know that you have that divinity with you. So when you associate with divinity, it becomes solitude. When you associate with your body and therefore with everything associated with the body, it becomes loneliness. So Dehabhimanam and Atmabhimanam is the difference between loneliness and solitude. How beautiful it is. And to seek solitude means, you know, going by what GV sir said and even by what Swami is saying now, for that solitude, you don't need anybody. You don't need numbers. Because it is, and in loneliness, irrespective of what numbers come, you will still be suffering. So therefore, the focus should not be at all on numbers, but on quality and growing spiritually, as Swami says here.
Right. And then the conversation goes on to another practical issue relating to the organization, where Hislop asks, "Swami, some questions arise in the American centers for which I do not have answers. Many people of Jewish faith do not understand why the symbol of the Jewish faith is not included in the Sai symbol of all religions. Since the Jewish people exceed in numbers, some of the religions represented in the Sai symbol." And Swami answers, "It is not through any intention that the Jewish symbol is excluded. In India, there is not a general awareness that the Jewish symbol is substantially different. Does the cross fail to symbolize the Jewish faith to a substantial degree?" Hislop says, "Yes, Swami, there is a substantial difference. Then let the Jewish people make a proposal to us and we will give consideration to it."
How practical and sweet.
Right. So this is how actually the Sarvadharma symbol went from being a five-petaled symbol to a six-petaled symbol. But, you know, from Swami's point of view, he's saying that, is there a difference?
In India, people, what he says is very true.
Very practical, true.
Only the intellectuals, and because there are not so many Jews in India, we mix them up together. Like, Jew is possibly a part of Christianity itself. That's how we generally think, unless you are actually educated in it. And so Swami says, no big deal in that. It has not been kept aside. It has been made because it began, originated in India. It has been based on India. You want it. In fact, I remember after a few years, the six-petaled Sarvadharma symbol was adopted by the Sri Satya Sai International Organization. And of late now, they've gone back to the five-petaled symbol, but instead of religious symbols, they have Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema and Ahimsa. The five eternal values, the values that are cherished and treasured by all religions. All religions value truth, righteousness, peace, love and non-violence. And that is the answer they've come up with, which I feel is a very practical one, because why not Shintoism? Why not Taoism? Why not, you know, the number of religions are growing now in the world. Very modern religions have come up. But any religion will be professing the same love for God, adherence to truth, adherence to righteousness. And that's why the Sri Satya Sai International Organization has replaced the five religious symbols with the five eternal values. That is the modification that they have done. But coming to this point, when this was pointed out, within a few years after that, the international organization was given a symbol with, as you said, a six-petaled
Star of David was
where the Star of David was incorporated, bang opposite to the Om symbol.
Right. Then what is to be understood is whether there are five or six or four. Swami has made it very clear it is a Sarva Dharma symbol. It is not a Pancha Dharma or something like that. So it is only representative. It represents all religions. So that was again a practical question that he asked. As you can see, these are all questions that he's asking in the capacity of an office bearer, getting some things cleared by Swami probably. And then he asks again a very general question. He says, Swami says that there is the duty of self-preservation. People wonder how far this goes. To save one's life, to save one's own life, should one kill the person who is attacking? And Swami's response to that is, to preserve one's body is an important duty. One may take whatever means are necessary for self-preservation. About the other part of your question, to kill the person attacking, the answer is yes, if that is the only way to preserve one's own life. But keep in mind that many alternative actions might be taken to avoid being killed. Only if every possibility has been exhausted may one take the extreme measure of killing the attacker. So Swami is making it very clear. I think one thing that we can right away say is very few of us will be in a situation like this. So technically we should not probably think about this so much, because then it will give a complicated idea of, you know, what about violence, what about this, Swami saying that. Very few of us will be in this. What needs to be probably taken very firmly from this is self-preservation, as Swami says, because this again, we've spoken about this when you talk about dharma. The basis of dharma is actually ahimsa. Swami would say ahimsa, ahimsa paramo dharma. And as we have said, as we saw a little earlier, not to harm others is the basic value. Swami said that a devotee should not harm others. But even the most fundamental dharma actually changes when one's life is threatened. And that's what is referred to as apad dharma. That at times when someone's life is in danger, the way you look at dharma slightly modifies. But the problem with us is, in anticipation of that crisis, we are ready to already compromise dharma, right? And that's the problem with even being stressed. When we talked about what happens when one undergoes stress, the response that the body does when under stress is meant only for when one is under stress. But when you are in stress for a long period of time, you tend to
think everything as life and death,
everything as a dangerous situation. And then what happens is you start compromising your morality over an extended period of time. And that's why I'm saying that very few of us will be in a situation where to...
Here also Swami is saying, if somebody is attacking you and your life is at stake also, try all other options.
Right.
If there's no other option, then only it's okay to attack back.
And then when I was thinking of this, all these options, then as Swami's devotees, I think one of those options is complete surrender to Swami. And maybe that is never out of the picture. Hmm. When can you ever, because as they beautifully would say, it might be a completely aside kind of anecdote. Hmm. There was once this debate apparently between Bhima and Arjuna, and everyone was asking like, who's closest to Krishna? And of course Arjuna felt that he was the closest to Krishna, because Krishna was of similar age and they had the relationship of friends,
and they have a shloka about them together,
right?
Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Partha Dhanu.
Exactly. So Arjuna felt that he, you know, and even from the point of view of who would spend more time with Krishna and all of that. So Bhima said that, you know, in what way are you so close? Let's see if you go and call Krishna, if he comes. So this was the time, I think, when they were in the forest or when they were in Indraprastha. I don't know exactly when it was. So Arjuna goes and invites Krishna to come for lunch or whatever it is. And Krishna says that, no, I'm very busy. I have these engagements and all that. So Arjuna comes away and Arjuna says that, no, Krishna is not available. So Bhima starts mocking at him and laughing. You claim to be so close to Krishna. See, you're not even able to make Krishna come here. Then Arjuna said, see, he must be really busy with something, otherwise he will not say no to me. Then Bhima challenges, I'll make Krishna come now, he says. And then how is that possible? So apparently Bhima picks up his maze and he throws it up in such a manner that it will come falling on his head. Right? And Bhima's mace is so heavy and it is so famed to, you know, even if you drop it on a person, it will kill him. So definitely it is going to, it's like suicidal. And he throws his maze up and he says, Krishna. And apparently Krishna appears there and catches the maze. And he's saying, you fool Bhima, what are you doing? And then Bhima says, no, I wanted to show everybody how you can make Krishna come. Right? So that story is spoken of as the amount of surrender and faith that Bhima had in Krishna, which was supposed to be higher than what even Arjuna or Yudhishthira had. Right? So if you have that kind of surrender, you probably will never be in a situation where to defend yourself, you will have to harm another person in that manner.
And one more important point in that story is, Bhima came from a place of joy and enthusiasm. He didn't do it in depression.
Right.
He's saying that, don't try to commit suicide and
tell
Swami,
call him.
Right. Yeah, if you want, you save me. It's not like that. Going ahead, Hislop says, Swami's discourse about people going to the Chandra Loka, the moon world, or the Surya Loka, the sun world, created much confusion. I think the previous discourse, either to the people in the interview room or public discourse, Swami must have spoken about it. And Swami says, Sai has explained it before and perhaps the people asking the question did not read. People may think there is a journey over a distance to the realm of Indra, Chandra or Surya. That is Indra, the moon and the sun. All such changes are within the person. If a person develops his life so that he has great physical force and strength, he is said to have centered his life on the Indra Loka. If he has developed his mind to such an extent that it is beyond the comprehension of an ordinary person, his life is said to be in the Chandra Loka or the moon world. If a person has developed intelligence to the maximum extent, then his life is said to be in the Surya Loka or the sun world. So with that, Swami makes it very clear that Chandra Loka and Surya Loka, they are not physical entities. If our focus is mainly on the body, a body which is filled with sense organs or the indriyas, we are supposed to be accomplishing the Indra Loka. That's why Indra Loka is considered as heaven, where there's a lot of comfort, physical comfort, you know, comfortable pillows, thrones, comfortable beds, nice cool air all around. It's all physical. But Swami says when you achieve that mentally, you're supposed to have reached the Chandra Loka, the world of the moon. And Surya Loka is when you progress spiritually. I think we had read this out earlier also. I will just read out that text from the Satya Sai Vahini where Swami says, we cannot think without words. Words are the essential material for thought. When the individual drops the body, the words enter the mind enters the life force, and the life force merges in the Atma. The embodied soul, when it liberates itself, rushes to the region of the solar principle or the Surya Loka. From there it reaches the region of Brahma or the Brahma Loka. Having reached the region, the individualized Atma has no more concern with nature or Prakriti. It will exist there till the end of time. It is boundless delight. So Swami says moksha happens in this manner where it merges and goes to the Surya Loka. Otherwise, what I have not got in my notes as quotes, is that Swami says, otherwise, it goes to the Chandra Loka, realm of the mind, where again it takes rebirth and comes back to the physical world. So, when Swami speaks of Indra Loka, Chandra Loka and Surya Loka, they are not some physical entities, they are just where our focus in life is.
Right. And I think Swami had spoken about this in some of these, some other Vahinis and even in Samoko's discourses. The whole idea is, Swami says that sun was the first object that man or primitive man, early man looked up as God. And he said that that is the source of all life forms. I mean, that's science, right? You have gain all your energy from that.
Sun only.
So sun was looked at as a representation of absolute divinity. And the moon was very early in his exploration. He figured out that it is bright because it is reflecting the light of the sun. So that is why moon was seen as a representation of the mind, right? So Swami would say that whatever good that you do, all the merit that you earn will give you a place in heaven. It is seen as a place in heaven. So that is the best or the highest that you can attain through your mental activity or the refinement of your mental activity. So Chandraloka was actually a representation of heaven. And Swami would say that you go to heaven, you have to return because you have not yet sublimated your ahankara completely. So you will, just like Swami would give the example of, you get elected to the parliament, 5 years you spend there, then you have to come back and get re-elected. Mm. So Swami would say that is going to heaven and coming back. But going to Suryaloka is nothing but you traveling towards this ultimate supreme, where you're slowly sublimating your ahankara and mamakara and doership. And eventually when you reach the supreme, then you will not come back. And that is why that spiritual life is spoken of as being Uttarayanam, that is moving towards the sun. And worldly life is spoken of as being a Dakshinayanam, which is actually moving towards the Chandraloka. So Chandraloka and Suryaloka, it's not like you go in, as you were saying, not that you get a place in the sun and, or you go to the moon, exploration in the moon or something like that. It is purely in the basis of this, that the Chandraloka represents only that enjoyment, which is a reflected enjoyment of the absolute. The Suryaloka is that where you, there is the place of no return, where you completely merge in that, and then, you know, as Swami says in Satsaya Vaini, you reside there till the end of time, which means there is no duality after that.
Hmm. On that note, dear listeners, I think we will be concluding. Actually, the next point was what I was very excited about when I read, which is about, you know, a human birth and animal births and how it progresses. But I guess it will have to wait for a fortnight more now, because the next fortnight is the Sanatana Sarathi fortnight. We will be going through that. But definitely I will retain my excitement and anticipation and share. We will go back to conversation with Bhagwan Sri Satsai Baba after the coming fortnight. Meanwhile, this Saturday again, dear listeners, those of you who tuned into our YouTube channel last Saturday for a discussion on why does bad happen even when we do good, and we had a discussion on the karma theory. We will be having the second part of that discussion this Saturday again at 7 p.m. You can catch us live on our YouTube channel, on the Radio Sai YouTube channel. And in case you are not able to catch us live at 7 p.m. Indian Standard Time, nothing to worry. Once the satsang is done, it will remain on YouTube for all to see. We must thank all of you for your wonderful responses, for your heartfelt appreciation, for your good wishes, for your love and affection that you have poured on us through mails, through WhatsApp messages, through comments on the video itself. We are also grateful to you for the many questions. Though we will not be able to go through and answer all of them, those questions have given us direction and they have shaped the next satsang that we have planned. So eagerly look forward to seeing you all Saturday at 7 p.m. On that note, we will end with a song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Radha Lola Ramya Suchela, Radha Lola Ramya Suchela, Vanamala Gopala,
Rajita Vanamala
सुजेला
राजित वनमाला गोपाला
राजित वनमाला